Listening Library presents The Lost Years of Merlin by T.A. Barron. Read for you by Michael Kumpsty, featuring an introduction read by the author.
Hello, this is T.A. Barron. I don't know much about wizards, but I have learned this much. They are full of surprises. Almost a decade ago, as I finished writing a book called The Merlin Effect, which follows a single strand of Arthurian lore from ancient Druid times all the way to the 21st century, I realized that the strand had tangled me up so completely I couldn't possibly escape. The strand was Merlin himself. Oh, he is a truly captivating and mysterious fellow, this wizard who can live backward in time, defy the legendary threefold death, and even seek the Holy Grail while still speaking with the spirit of rivers and trees. I realized I really wanted to get to know him better. Now, whether Merlin was ever real or not in the realm of history, a question people have hotly debated, he is certainly real in the realm of imagination. There he has long lived, and there he continues to thrive. And best of all, he even welcomes visitors on occasion. So before I could even start to protest, Merlin made his own plans for me. My other books and projects had to wait. He was ready, no, eager, to reveal at last the secret story of his lost years. To be sure, I knew well that making even a small contribution to his already rich body of legend would be a daunting challenge, but I was very curious, and Merlin was very insistent. Then came the wizard's first surprise. As I immersed myself in the traditional tales, stretching back to the ancient Celtic sagas first set down 1,000 years ago in the Mabinogion, I found a huge gap in the lore. Merlin's youth, that crucial time when he would have discovered his own identity, his own origins, and his own powers, was mentioned only fleetingly, if at all. Where he first tasted sorrow, first found joy, first gained a particle or two of wisdom, all that remained unexplored. And so I started to wonder about young Merlin's life. What were his greatest struggles, his deepest fears, his highest aspirations? How did he discover his true passions and his hidden gifts? How did he come to know and ultimately accept his own dark side? Where did he first encounter the spirituality of the Druids, the early Christians, and even the Greeks? How did he reconcile his own yearning for power and his horror at its abuses? In sum, just how did he become the wizard and mentor to King Arthur we celebrate today? These questions are not answered by the traditional lore. No, their answers lie somewhere else. You see, Merlin's youth disappeared from the world of story and song for one simple reason. In those years, Merlin himself disappeared from the world as we know it. That is why they truly are his lost years. The story, spanning several volumes, begins not with a wizard, but with a boy. A boy who, barely alive, washes ashore on the coast of Wales. Bedraggled and half-drowned, he has no memory at all of his past. Not his parents, not his childhood, not even his own name. And the story concludes when that same boy, having gained a lot and lost even more, is ready at last to step into his central role in Arthurian legend, to be the greatest wizard of all times, the Mage of Camelot, the man we call Merlin. In between, a lot happens. Merlin makes some very good friends and one very bad enemy. He discovers his second sight, but pays dearly for it. He learns the languages of trees and how to run with the grace of a deer. He finds the original Stonehenge, though he first must learn the meaning of Stonehenge's druid name, Dance of the Giants. He gains, at last, the name Merlin, as well as his true soul name, and he voyages to the lost Isle of Finchaira, known in Celtic myth as an island beneath the waves, a bridge between earth and heaven. This place was best described by Merlin's mother, who called it an in-between place, much like the mist swirling about its shores, which was neither quite water nor quite air, but something of both, and yet something else entirely. Finchaira, too, is in between. It is both mortal and immortal, dark and light, fragile and everlasting. Just how fragile it truly is, Merlin will discover. It is the journey of Merlin's lost years that made him ready for what lies ahead, that prepared him for his role as mentor to King Arthur, whose idealistic goals would fail in his own realm, but would lodge forever in the realm of the heart. For in his lost years, Merlin truly becomes a wizard of many worlds and many times. Do you think that half-drowned boy who is spat out by the sea in the opening scene could have guessed his own remarkable future? No, not at all. And so the story begins with these words. If I close my eyes and breathe to the rolling rhythm of the sea, I can still remember that long ago day. Harsh, cold, and lifeless it was, as empty of promise as my lungs were empty of air. And yet, Merlin did find great promise and great triumph, and that, I believe, is his biggest surprise. For the lad who washed ashore on that fateful day was more than just a boy. He was truly a metaphor for us all. Perhaps, like that boy, each and every one of us has some hidden gifts. They may be invisible to everyone, even ourselves, and yet remain there, just waiting to be discovered. And who knows, perhaps, like that boy, we have a bit of magic as well. Magic that just might hold the makings of a wizard. So come with me now as Merlin reveals to us, at last, the story of his lost years. In this journey, you are the witness, I am the scribe, and Merlin himself is our guide. But let us beware, for a wizard, as we know, is full of surprises.
Hey, that matter with his haunt, wind and water, wold and land, gave him all a good ending, that wollen listener this talking, and he shall tell you before who Merlin was getten and bore, and of his wisdoms also, and odra happers many more, some will befell in Engeland.
From the 13th century ballad of Arthur and of Merlin. Prologue. If I close my eyes and breathe to the rolling rhythm of the sea, I can still remember that long ago day. Harsh, cold, and lifeless it was, as empty of promise as my lungs were empty of air. Since that day, I have seen many others, more than I have the strength left to count. Yet that day glows as bright as the Galator itself, as bright as the day I found my own name, or the day I first cradled a baby who bore the name Arthur. Perhaps I remember it so clearly because the pain, like a scar on my soul, will not disappear, or because it marked the ending of so much, or perhaps because it marked a beginning as well as an ending. The beginning of my lost years. A dark wave rose on the rolling sea, and from it lifted a hand. As the wave surged higher, reaching towards sky as smoky gray as itself, The hand reached higher as well. A bracelet of foam swirled around the wrist, while desperate fingers groped for something they could not find. It was the hand of someone small. It was the hand of someone weak, too weak to fight any longer. It was the hand of a boy. With a deep sucking sound, the wave began to crest, tilting steadily toward the shore. For an instant, it paused, hovering between ocean and land, between the brooding Atlantic and the perilous, rock-bound coast of Wales, known in those days as Gwynedd. Then the sucking swelled into a crashing roar as the wave toppled over, hurling the boy's limp body onto the black rocks. His head smacked against a stone so violently that his skull would surely have split open were it not for the thick mat of hair that covered it. He lay completely still, except when the whoosh of air from the next wave tousled his locks, black beneath the stains of blood. A shabby seagull, seeing his motionless form, hopped over the jumble of rocks for a closer look. Bending its beak toward the boy's face, it tried to pull a strand of sea kelp that was wrapped around his ear. The bird tugged and twisted, squawking angrily. At last, the kelp broke free. Triumphantly, the bird jumped down to one of the boy's bare arms. Beneath the shreds of a brown tunic still clinging to him, he seemed small, even for a boy of 7 years. Yet something about his face, the shape of his brow, perhaps, or the lines around his eyes, seemed far older. At that instant, he coughed, vomited seawater, and coughed again. With a screech, the gull dropped the kelp and fluttered off to a stony perch. The boy remained motionless for a moment. All he could taste was sand, slime, and vomit. All he could feel was the painful throbbing of his head and the rocks jabbing into his shoulders. Then came another cough, another gush of seawater, a halting, labored breath, then a second breath and a third. Slowly his slender hand clenched into a fist. Waves surged and subsided. For a long while, the small candle flame of life in him wavered at the edge of darkness. Beneath the throbbing, his mind seemed strangely empty, almost as if he had lost a piece of his very self, or as if a kind of wall had been erected, cutting him off from a portion of himself, leaving nothing but a lingering sense of fear. His breathing slowed, his fist relaxed. He gasped, as if to cough again, but instead fell still. Cautiously, the seagull edged closer. Then, from whatever quarter, a thin thread of energy began to move through his body. Something inside him was not yet ready to die. He stirred again, breathed again. The gull froze. He opened his eyes. Shivering with cold, he rolled to his side. Feeling the rough sand in his mouth, he tried to spit, but succeeded only in making himself gag from the rancid taste of kelp and brine. With effort, he raised an arm and wiped his mouth with the tatters of his tunic. Then he winced, feeling the raw lump on the back of his head. Willing himself to sit up, he braced his elbow against a rock and pushed himself upright. He sat there listening to the grinding and splashing sea. Beyond the ceaseless pulsing of the waves, beyond the pounding inside his head, he thought for an instant that he could hear something else. A voice, perhaps. A voice from some other time, some other place, though he could not remember where. With a sudden jolt, he realized that he could not remember anything. Where he had come from. His mother, his father, his name, his own name. Hard as he tried, he could not remember. His own name. Who am I? Hearing his cry, the gull squawked and took flight. Catching sight of his reflection in a pool of water, he paused to look. A strange face, belonging to a boy he did not know, peered back at him. His eyes, like his hair, were as black as coal, with scattered flecks of gold. His ears, which were almost triangular and pointed at the top, seemed oddly large for the rest of his face, Likewise, his brow rose high above his eyes, yet his nose looked narrow and slight, more a beak than a nose. Altogether, his face did not seem to belong to itself. He mustered his strength and rose to his feet. Head swirling, he braced himself against a pinnacle of rock until the dizziness calmed. His eyes roamed over the desolate coastline. Rocks upon rocks lay scattered everywhere, making a harsh black barrier to the sea. The rocks parted in only one place, and then only grudgingly, around the roots of an ancient oak tree. Its gray bark peeling, the old oak faced the ocean with the stance of centuries. There was a deep hollow in its trunk, gouged out by fire ages ago. Age warped its every branch, twisting some into knots. Yet it continued to stand, roots anchored, immutable against storm and sea. Behind the oak stood a dark grove of younger trees, and behind them, high cliffs loomed even darker. Desperately, the boy searched the landscape for anything he might recognize, anything that might coax his memory to return. He recognized nothing. He turned, despite the stinging salt spray, to the open sea. Waves rolled and toppled, one after another, nothing but endless gray billows as far as he could see. He listened again for the mysterious voice, but heard only the distant call of a kittiwake perched on the cliffs. Had he come from somewhere out there, beyond the sea? Vigorously, he rubbed his bare arms to stop the shivers. Spying a loose clump of sea kelp on a rock, he picked it up. Once, he knew, this formless mass of green had danced with its own graceful rhythm before being uprooted and cast adrift. Now it hung limp in his hand. He wondered why he himself had been uprooted, and from where. A low moaning sound caught his ear. That voice again. It came from the rocks beyond the old oak tree. He lurched forward in the direction of the voice. For the first time, he noticed a dull ache between his shoulder blades. He could only assume that his back, like his head, had slammed against the rocks. Yet the ache felt somehow deeper, as if something beneath his shoulders had been torn away long ago. After several halting steps, he made it to the ancient tree. He leaned against its massive trunk, his heart pounding. Again he heard the mysterious moaning. Again he set off. Often his bare feet would slip on the wet rocks, pitching him sideways. Stumbling along, his torn brown tunic flapping about his legs, he resembled an ungainly water bird picking his way across the shoreline. Yet all the time he knew what he really was. A lone boy with no name and no home. Then he saw her. Crumpled among the stones lay the body of a woman, her face beside a surging tidal pool. Her long, unbraided hair, the color of a yellow summer moon, spread about her head like rays of light. She had strong cheekbones and a complexion that would be described as creamy were it not tinged with blue. Her long blue robe, torn in places, was splotched with sand and sea kelp. Yet the quality of the wool, as well as the jeweled pendant on a leather cord around her neck, revealed her to have been once a woman of wealth and stature. He rushed forward. The woman moaned again, a moan of inextinguishable pain. He could almost feel her agony, even as he could feel his own hopes rising. "Do I know her?" he asked himself as he bent over her twisted body. Then from a place of deeper longing, "Does she know me?" With a single finger, he touched her cheek, as cold as the cold sea. He watched her take several short, labored breaths. He listened to her wretched moaning, and with a sigh he admitted to himself that she was, for him, a complete stranger. Still, as he studied her, he could not suppress the hope that she might have arrived on this shore together with him. If she had not come on the same wave, then at least she might have come from the same place. Perhaps if she lived, she might be able to fill the empty cup of his memory. Perhaps she knew his very name. or the names of his mother and father, or perhaps she might actually be his mother. A frigid wave slapped against his legs. His shivers returned, even as his hopes faded. She might not live, and even if she did, she probably would not know him. And she certainly could not be his mother. That was too much to hope for. Besides, she could not have looked less like him. She looked truly beautiful, even at the edge of death, as beautiful as an angel. And he had seen his own reflection. He knew what he looked like. Less like an angel than a bedraggled, half-grown demon. A snarl erupted from behind his back. The boy whirled around, his stomach clenched. There, in the shadows of the dark grove, stood an enormous wild boar. A low, vicious growl vibrating in its throat, the boar stepped out of the trees. Bristling brown fur covered its entire body, except for the eyes, and a gray scar snaking down its left foreleg. Its tusks, sharp as daggers, were blackened with the blood of a previous kill. More frightening, though, were its red eyes, which glowed like hot coals. The boar moved smoothly, almost lightly, despite its hulking form. The boy stepped backward. This beast outweighed him several times over. One kick of its leg would send him sprawling. One stab of its tusk would rip his flesh to shreds. Abruptly, the boar stopped and hunched its muscular shoulders, preparing to charge. Glancing behind, the boy could see only the onrushing waves of the ocean. No escape that way. He grabbed a crooked shard of driftwood to use as a weapon, though he knew it would not even begin to pierce the boar's hide. Even so, he tried to plant his feet on the slippery rocks, bracing for the attack. Then he remembered the hollow in the old oak. Although the trees stood about halfway between him and the boar, he might be able to get there first. He started to dash for the tree, then suddenly caught himself. The woman! He could not just leave her there. Yet his own chance for safety depended on speed. Grimacing, he tossed aside the driftwood and grabbed her limp arms. Straining his trembling legs, he tried to pull her free from the rocks. Whether from all the water she had swallowed or from the weight of death upon her, she felt as heavy as the rocks themselves. Finally, under the glaring eyes of the boar, she budged. The boy began dragging her toward the tree. Sharp stones cut into his feet. Heart racing, head throbbing, he pulled with all his power. The boar snarled again, this time more like a raspy laugh. The whole body of the beast tensed, nostrils flaring and tusks gleaming. Then it charged. Though the boy was only a few feet from the tree, something kept him from running. He snatched a squarish stone from the ground and hurled it at the boar's head. Only an instant before reaching them, the boar changed direction. The stone whizzed past and clattered on the ground. Amazed that he could have possibly daunted the beast, the boy quickly bent to retrieve another stone. Then, sensing some movement over his shoulder, he spun around. Out of the bushes behind the ancient oak bounded an immense stag. Bronze in hue, except for the white boots on each leg that shone like purest quartz. The stag lowered its great rack of antlers. With the 7 points on each side aimed like so many spears, the stag leapt at the boar, but the beast swerved aside just in time to dodge the thrust. As the boar careened and snarled ferociously, the stag leapt once again. Seizing the moment, the boy dragged the limp woman into the hollow of the tree. By folding her legs tight against her chest, he pushed her entirely into the opening. The wood, still charred from some ancient fire, curled around her like a great black shell. He wedged himself into the small space beside her as the boar and the stag circled each other, pawing the ground and snorting wrathfully. Eyes aflame, the boar feigned a charge at the stag, then bolted straight at the tree. Hunched in the hollow, the boy drew back as far as he could. Yet his face remained so close to the gnarled bark of the opening that he still could feel the boar's hot breath as its tusks slashed wildly at the trunk. One of the tusks grazed the boy's face, gashing him just below the eye. At that moment, the stag plowed into the flank of the boar. The bulky beast flew into the air and landed on its side near the bushes. Blood oozing from a punctured thigh, the boar scrambled to its feet. The stag lowered its head, poised to leap again. Hesitating for a split second, the boar snarled one final time before retreating into the trees. With majestic slowness, the stag turned toward the boy. For a brief moment, their eyes met. Somehow the boy knew that he would remember nothing from that day so clearly as the bottomless brown pools of the stag's unblinking eyes, eyes as deep and mysterious as the ocean itself. Then, as swiftly as it had appeared, the stag leapt over the twisted roots of the oak and vanished from sight. Part 1. Chapter 1. A Living Eye. I stand alone, beneath the stars. The entire sky ignites into flame, as if a new sun is being born. People shriek and scatter, but I stand there unable to move, unable to breathe. Then I see the tree, darker than a shadow against the flaming sky. Its burning branches writhe like deadly serpents. They reach for me. The fiery branches come closer. I try to escape, but my legs are made of stone. My face is burning. I hide my eyes. I scream. My face is burning. I awoke. Perspiration stung my eyes. Straw from my palate scratched against my face. Blinking, I drew a deep breath and wiped my face with my hands. They felt cool against my cheeks. Stretching my arms, I felt again that pain between my shoulder blades, still there. I wished it would go away. Why should it still bother me now, more than 5 years since the day I had washed ashore? The wounds to my head had long since healed, though I still remembered nothing of my life before being thrown on the rocks. So why should this wound last so much longer? I shrugged. Like so much else, I would never know. I started to stuff some loose straw back into the pallet when my fingers uncovered an ant, dragging the body of a worm several times its size. I watched, almost laughing, as the ant tried to climb straight up the miniature mountain of straw. It could have easily gone around one side or another. But no, some mysterious motive drove it to try, spill over backward, try again, and spill again. For several minutes, I watched this repeating performance. At last, I took pity on the little fellow. I reached for one of its legs, then realized that it might twist off, especially if the ant struggled. So I picked up the worm instead. Just as I expected, the ant clung to it, kicking frantically. I carried the ant and its prize up and over the straw, dropping them gently on the other side. To my surprise, when I released my hold on the worm, so did the ant. It turned toward me, waving its tiny antennae wildly. I caught the distinct feeling that I was being scolded. "My apologies," I whispered through my grin. The ant scolded me for a few more seconds, then it bit into the worm and started to drag the heavy load away. To its home. My grin faded. Where could I find my own home? I would drag behind me this whole pallet, this whole hut, if necessary, if only I knew where to go. Turning to the open window above my head, I saw the full moon glowing as bright as a pot of molten silver. Moonlight poured through the window and through the gaps in the thatched roof, painting the interior of the hut with its gleaming brush. For a moment, the moonlight nearly disguised the poverty of the room, covering the earthen floor with a sheath of silver, the rough clay walls with sparkles of light, the still sleeping form in the corner. with the glow of an angel. Yet I knew that it was all an illusion, no more real than my dream. The floor was just dirt, the bed just straw, the dwelling just a hovel made of twigs bound with clay. The covered pen for the geese next door had been constructed with more care. I knew, for I sometimes hid myself in there, when the honking and hissing of geese sounded more to my liking than the howling and chattering of people. The pen stayed warmer than this hut in February, and drier in May. Even if I did not deserve any better than the geese, no one could doubt that Branwen did. I watched her sleeping form, her breathing, so subtle that it hardly lifted her woolen blanket, seemed calm and peaceful. Alas, I knew better. While peace might visit her in sleep, it escaped her in waking life. She shifted in her slumber, rolling her face toward mine. In the lunar light, she looked even more beautiful than usual, her creamy cheeks and brow thoroughly relaxed, as they were only on such nights when she slept soundly, or in her moments of silent prayer, which happened more and more often. I frowned at her. If only she would speak, tell me what she knew. For if she did know anything about our past, she had refused to discuss it. Whether that was because she truly did not know, or because she simply did not want me to know, I could never tell. And in the 5 years we had shared this hut, she had revealed little more about herself. But for the kind touch of her hand and the ever-present sorrow at the back of her eyes, I hardly knew her at all. I only knew that she was not my mother, as she claimed. How could I be so sure that she was not my mother? Somehow in my heart I knew. She was too distant, too secretive. Surely a mother, a real mother, wouldn't hide so much from her own son. And if I needed any more assurance, I had only to look at her face. So lovely, and so very different from my own. There was no hint of black in those eyes, nor of points on those ears. No, I was no more her son than the geese were my siblings. Nor could I believe that her real name was Branwen, and that mine was Emrys, as she had tried to convince me. Whatever names we had possessed before the sea had spat us out on the rocks, I felt sure somehow that they were not those. As many times as she had called me Emrys, I could not shake the feeling that my true name was something else. Yet I had no idea where to look for the truth, except perhaps in the wavering shadows of my dreams. The only times that Branwen, if that was really her name, would show even a hint of her true self were when she told me stories, especially the stories of the ancient Greeks. Those tales were clearly her favorites, and mine, too. Whether she knew it or not, some part of her seemed to come alive when she spoke of the giants and gods, the monsters and quests in the Greek myths. True, she also enjoyed telling tales of the druid healers or the miracle worker from Galilee, but her stories about the Greek gods and goddesses brought a special light into her sapphire eyes. At times, I almost felt that telling these stories was her way of talking about a place that she believed really existed, a place where strange creatures roamed the land and great spirits mingled with humans. The whole notion seemed foolish to me, but apparently not to her. A sudden flash of light at her throat curtailed my thoughts. I knew that it was only the light of the moon reflected in her jeweled pendant still hanging from the leather cord around her neck, although the green color seemed richer tonight than ever before. I realized that I had never seen her take the pendant off, not even for an instant. Something tapped on the dirt behind me. I turned to see a bundle of dried leaves, slender and silvery in the moonlight, bound with a knot of grass. It must have fallen from the ridge beam above, which supported not only the thatch, but but also dozens of clusters of herbs, leaves, flowers, roots, nuts, bark shavings, and seeds. These were only a portion of Branwen's collection, for many more bundles hung from the window frame, the back of the door, and the tilting table beside her pallet. Because of the bundles, the whole hut smelled of thyme, beetroot, mustard seed, and more. I loved the aromas, except for dill, which made me sneeze. Cedar bark, my favorite, lifted me as tall as a giant. Petals of lavender tingled my toes, and sea kelp reminded me of something I could not quite remember. All these ingredients and tools she used to make her healing powders, pastes, and poultices. Her table held a large assortment of bowls, knives, mortars, pestles, strainers, and other utensils. Often I watched her crushing leaves, mixing powders, straining plants, or applying a mixture of remedies to someone's wound or wart. Yet I knew as little about her healing work as I did about her. While she allowed me to watch, she would not converse or tell stories. She merely worked away, usually singing some chant or other. Where had she learned so much about the art of healing? Where had she discovered the tales of so many distant lands and times? Where had she first encountered the teachings of the man from Galilee that increasingly occupied her thoughts? She would not say. I was not alone in being vexed by her silence. Oftentimes the villagers would whisper behind her back, wondering about her healing powers, her unnatural beauty, her strange chants. I had even heard the words sorcery and black magic used once or twice, although it did not seem to discourage people from coming to her when they needed a boil healed, a cough cured, or a nightmare dispelled. Branwen herself did not seem worried by the whisperings. As long as most people paid her for her help, so that we could continue to make our way, she did not seem to care what they might think or say. Recently, she had tended to an elderly monk who had slipped on the wet stones of the mill bridge and gashed his arm. While binding his wound, Branwen uttered a Christian blessing, which seemed to please him. When she followed it with a druid chant, however, he scolded her and warned her against blasphemy. She replied calmly that Jesus himself was so devoted to healing others that he might well have drawn upon the wisdom of the druids as well as others now called pagan. At that point, the monk angrily shook off her bandage and left, though not before telling half the village that she was doing the work of demons. I turned back to the pendant. It seemed to shine with its own light, not just the moon's. For the first time, I noticed that the crystal in its center was not merely flat green, as it appeared from a distance. Leaning closer, I discovered violets and blues flowing like rivulets beneath its surface, while glints of red pulsed with 1,000 tiny hearts. It looked almost like a living eye. Galator. The word sprung suddenly into my mind. It is called Galator. I shook my head, puzzled. Where did that word come from? I could not recall ever having heard it. I must have picked it up from the village square, where numerous dialects, Celt, Saxon, Roman, Gaelic, and others, even more strange, collided and merged every day. Or perhaps from one of Branwen's own stories, which were sprinkled with words from the Greeks, the Jews, the Druids, and others more ancient still.
Emrys!
Her shrill whisper startled me so much that I jumped. I faced the bluer-than-blue eyes of the woman who shared with me her hut and her meals, but nothing more.
You are awake.
I am.
And you were staring at me strangely.
Not at you, I replied. At your pendant. On an impulse, I added,
at your Galator.
She gasped. With a sweep of her hand, she stuffed the pendant under her robe. Then, trying to keep her voice calm, she said,
that is not a word I remember telling you.
My eyes widened.
You mean it is the real word, the right word?
She observed me thoughtfully, almost started to speak, then caught herself.
"You should be sleeping, my son."
As always, I bristled when she called me that. "I can't sleep."
"Would a story help? I could finish the one about Apollo."
"No, not now."
"I could make you a potion then."
"No, thanks," I shook my head.
"When you did that for the Thatcher's son, he slept for 3.5 days.
A smile touched her lips.
"He drank a week's dose at once, poor fool."
"It's almost dawn, anyway." She gathered her rough wool blanket.
"Well, if you don't want to sleep, I do." "Before you do, can't you tell me more about that word, Gal? Oh, what was it?"
Seeming not to hear me, she wrapped herself in her customary cloak of silence. Even as she wrapped herself in the wool blanket and closed her eyes once more, in seconds she seemed to be asleep again. Yet the peace I had seen in her face before had flown.
"Can't you tell me?"
She did not stir.
"Why don't you ever help me?" I wailed. "I need your help."
Still she did not stir. Ruefully, I watched her for a while. Then I rolled off the pallet, stood and splashed my face with water from the large wooden bowl by the door. Glancing again at Branwen, I felt a renewed surge of anger.
Why wouldn't she answer me? Why wouldn't she help me?
Yet even as I looked upon her, I felt a small prick of guilt that I had never been able to bring myself to call her mother, although I knew how much it would please her. And yet, what kind of mother would refuse to help her son? I tugged against the rope handle of the door. With a scrape against the dirt, it opened, and I left the hut. Chapter 2. An Owl is Coming. The western sky had darkened as the moon had nearly set. Streaks of silver shading into gray lined the thick clouds above the village of Caer Vedwit. In the dim light, its humped roofs of thatch looked like a group of shadowed boulders. Somewhere nearby I heard lambs crying, and my friends, the geese, began to wake up. A cuckoo in the bracken called twice. Under the dripping oak and ash trees, the fresh scent of bluebells mingled with the smell of wet thatch. It was May. And in May, even a dreary village before dawn could seem lovely. I pulled a burr from the sleeve of my tunic, listening to the quiet stirrings. This month excited me like no other. Flowers opened their faces to the sky, lambs birthed, leaves sprouted, and as the flowers blossomed, so did my dreams. Sometimes in May, I swallowed my doubts and believed that one day I would find the truth, who I really was, where I really came from. If not from Branwen, then from someone else. In May, anything seemed possible. If only I could learn to harness time itself, to make every month like May, or perhaps to live backward in time, so that whenever the end of the month arrived, I could turn May right around and live it all over again. I chewed my lip. Whatever the month, this village would never be my favorite place, nor my home. I knew this early hour would be the finest of the day, before the sun's rays revealed its tattered huts and fearful faces. Like most villages in this rolling, thickly wooded country, Caer Vedwid existed only because of an old Roman road. Ours ran along the north bank of the river Tue, which flowed south all the way to the sea. Although the road had once carried streams of Roman soldiers, it now carried mainly vagabonds and wandering traders. It was a towpath for horses bringing barges of grain down the river, a route for those seeking the Church of St. Peter in the city of Caer Mirthin to the south, and also, as I remembered well, a passage to the sea. A metal tool clanged in the smith's shop under the great oak. I could hear a horse tramping somewhere up the towpath, its bridle jingling. In another hour, people would be gathering in the square, under the tree, where the village's three main paths converged. Soon the sounds of bartering, arguing, cajoling, and, of course, thieving would fill the air. 5 years in this place, and it still did not feel like home. Why? Perhaps because everything, from the local gods to the local names, was changing, fast. The newly arrived Saxons had already started to call Iwithfa, whose icy ridges towered over everything, Snow Hill or Snowdon. Likewise, people were now calling this region, long known as Gunnedd, the country of Wales. But to call it a country at all was to imply a kind of unity that did not really exist. Given the number of travelers and dialects that passed through just our little village every day, Wales seemed to me less a country than a way station. Following the path down to the mill house, I saw the last traces of moonlight touching the slopes of Iwithfa. The sounds of the waking village melted into the splashy clatter of the river flowing under the stone bridge by the mill. A frog bellowed somewhere by the mill house, the only building in the village made of real brick. Without warning, a quiet voice within me whispered, "An owl is coming." I whirled about just in time to see the square head and massive brown wings sail past me as fast as the wind and as silent as death. 2 seconds later, it dropped into the grass behind the mill house, its talons squeezing the life out of its prey. "Stoat for supper," I grinned to myself, pleased that I had somehow known that the owl was approaching and that its invisible quarry was a stoat. How did I know? I had no idea. I simply knew, that's all, and I supposed that any reasonably observant person would have known as well. More and more, though, I wondered. I did sometimes seem a step ahead of other people in sensing what was about to happen. This talent, if you could call it a talent, had only just appeared in the last few weeks, so I didn't even begin to understand it. And I hadn't shared it with Branwen or with anyone else. It could be nothing more than a string of lucky guesses. But if, in fact, it was something more, it might at least provide some entertainment, or even prove useful in a pinch. Only the day before, I had seen some village boys chasing one another with imaginary swords. For a brief moment, I longed to be one of them. Then the group's leader, Denatius, spied me and pounced on me before I could get away. I had never liked Denatius, who had spent the years since his mother's death as the smith's servant. He struck me as mean, stupid, and quick-tempered. But I had tried never to offend him, less out of kindness than the fact that he was much older and much larger than I or any other boy in the village. More than once I had seen him struck by the smith's powerful hand for shirking his duties, and just as often I had seen Denatius do the same to someone smaller. Once he badly burned the arm of another boy who had dared to question his Roman ancestry. All this ran through my mind the day before, as I struggled to get away from him. Then I chanced to see a low-flying gull overhead. I pointed to the bird and cried, "Look, treasure from the sky!" Denatius turned his face skyward at just the moment that the bird released an especially pungent sort of treasure, which splatted him right in the eye. While Denatius cursed and tried to wipe his face, the other boys laughed, and I escaped. Smiling, I thought of yesterday's close call. For the first time, I wondered whether I might possess a talent, a power, even more precious than predicting events. Suppose, just suppose, I could actually control events, make something happen, not with my hands, my feet, or my voice, with nothing but my thoughts. How exciting! It was probably just another May dream, but what if it was more? I would give it a try.